Good morning and welcome to today's web seminar, Child Welfare Realignment, Just the Facts. My name is Amy Lemley with the John Burton Foundation. It's just a few minutes after 10. We're going to wait just a moment or two, I should say a minute or two, before we begin. Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's web seminar, Child Welfare Realignment, Just the Facts. My name is Amy Lemley, and I'm the Policy Director at the John Burton Foundation. We're very pleased to welcome over 300 registrants to today's web seminar. Before we begin, I want to briefly review the process for participating. After registering online, you should have received an email with a link to the webinar. When you click on that link, you should now be able to view the slideshow. To hear the audio portion of the webinar, the call-in number is the one you see on your screen, 951-266-6129, and the access code is 608-319-457. Then enter the audio PIN that appears on your screen. If you'd like to submit live questions during the web seminar, click on the answering question arrow on your screen. Type your question and click send. A number of you submitted questions in advance, and we will do our best to address those today. After the completion of the training, the recorded web seminar will be posted at the California Fostering Connections website at www.cafosteringconnections.org under past trainings. Today's web seminar will provide information about an important change in how California finances its foster care, child welfare services, and mental health, children's mental health. This policy change, known as realignment, was enacted by the California State Legislature last summer and has important long-term implications. By the completion of the web seminar, we hope that you will be familiar with the basic terminology of realignment and the key issues to be considered by the legislature. We also hope that you will understand why it is important to get involved in the conversation about child welfare realignment. Vital decisions will be made in the coming months that will have far-reaching implications for how children and youth are served in California for decades to come. The quality of these decisions will be improved by including the input of a broad range of individuals who are working every day to meet the needs of children and youth. We need your input so that together we can protect funding and strengthen programs for California's most vulnerable children. Today's presentation will include several parts. First, Angie Schwartz, attorney and policy director of the Alliance for Children's Rights, will begin with a brief explanation of 2011 realignment, including its stated goals, its fiscal effect, the account structure, and an overview of realigned programs. Angie will be followed by Susanna Niffen, senior associate at Children Now, who will review the revenue sources for 2001 realignment, discuss expenditure projections, and summarize the potential positive and negative implications of realignment. Next, we'll turn our attention to the governor's proposal for realignment. I will discuss his proposal that was released on January 5th and compare it with 2001 realignment. Finally, attorney Martha Matthews of Public Counsel will discuss the role of the California Department of Social Services under realignment and highlight issues of accountability. Before we begin, I would like to thank each of today's presenters and remind everyone listening that the web seminar will be taped and it will be available together with the presentation slides on the California Fostering Connections website. With this, let's turn it over to Angie Schwartz of the Alliance for Children's Rights.
Good morning, everyone. So we're going to start by just defining what we mean when we say realignment. What is realignment? What we're referring to is the legislation that passed last year, AB 118, that basically shifted responsibility for certain programs from the state to the counties. We're going to talk much more about which programs were realigned and exactly how that happened, but we just wanted to start with a definition of what realignment really means. It's important to note that AB 118, the bill that realigned health and human services programs along with public safety programs, was one-year legislation. It was intended as a placeholder for more permanent legislation, which is being considered this year. It fiscally realigned the programs. It didn't really change much from a programmatic perspective, and we'll be talking much more about that. So next slide. So here we have the stated policy goals of realignment as outlined in the governor's budget summary that was recently released. It's important to note that these are goals. They're ideals. It's not certain that realignment will actually produce any of these outcomes. There's no evidence that says realigning programs and services is more likely to achieve these stated goals, but it's good to know that these are the goals that the governor is working towards and hoping that realignment will produce. So you can see some of them there, having government focus on the core functions, dedicating revenues to fund these programs, reducing duplication, minimizing overhead costs. These are the things that the governor is hoping realignment will achieve. Next slide. But beyond the stated policy goals, there's also a real fiscal impact of realignment. And again, this comes from the Legislative Analyst Office report that was released back in August of 2011, explaining what the real fiscal impact is to the state, what that effect is of realignment. Because keep in mind that realigning revenue from the state to the counties doesn't by itself have a huge fiscal impact, at least not in the initial years, because the state has realigned the programs and realigned the responsibility for funding those programs to the counties, but they also have realigned revenue sources that used to go into the state general fund and now are going into these realignment funds. And so while there's less money coming into the state general fund, those funds are now being diverted to the counties to pay for these programs. So where does the actual savings come from? And as the LAO report explains, that really comes from a reduction of the state's Prop 98 obligation. And Proposition 98 was passed back in 1988, and it requires a minimum percentage of the state's general fund budget to be spent on K-12 education. So under realignment, sales tax revenue is no longer deposited into the general fund. Rather, it's being deposited into a special realignment fund that's distributed to the counties. And what that means is the assumption is that sales tax revenue that's no longer being deposited into the general fund is no longer counted as state revenue for purposes of calculating that minimum obligation that has to be spent for K-14 education. And the savings to the state in the LAO report estimates to be about $2.1 billion. Just want to note that there are outstanding...
I'm sorry about that. We've gotten a few requests for you to speak up.
Oh, sorry. So just wanted to note that there are outstanding questions about the repayment of these funds to the schools, so that $2.1 billion, how that's going to be repaid to the schools is still being worked out. But the savings, the reduction of the Prop 98 obligation as a result of this realigned structure comes from really the savings generated by the state's reduced obligation under Proposition 98. The bulk of the savings comes from Prop 98, but we also wanted to point out that using that vehicle licensing fee to fund local law enforcement reduces the state's cost by about $453 million. So obviously the $2.1 billion is really where the bulk of the fiscal impact is coming from as a result of realignment. Next slide. So these are categories of programs that were realigned. These are the state functions that were realigned. And again, this is from the LEO's August report and the governor's budget summary. There are really two overarching categories of programs that were realigned: public safety programs, which you can see in the white boxes, and health and human services programs, which is our focus today. The amount of funding realigned for these two overarching functions, public safety and health and human services, is really about equal, although health and human services is the bigger chunk of the pie. The public safety programs amount to about $2.6 billion in realigned programs, and as you can see on the HHS slide or box there, it's about $2.9 billion of realigned programs that fall under the health and services programs. And I think that's really notable, particularly because it isn't how realignment has really been portrayed in the media and in the news. I think as we've talked about realignment in the public, people think that it's been public safety programs that were realigned, and that's just not the case. Our programs were realigned and actually make up a small majority, but a majority of the funding of the programs that were realigned. So next slide. We'll dig in a little deeper about what's included in that health and human services account. And these are categories of programs that were realigned under the health and human services account. The blue programs are the ones we're all focused on. They're the ones that impact the kids and the families that we all serve: child welfare services, child abuse prevention, foster care, adoptions, and the adoption assistance program. And notably, those blue programs are obviously the vast majority of the money that's coming out of the health and human services programs that were realigned. Those yellow boxes there are set to join the list of realigned programs in 2012-13. So that is coming, EPSDT and mental health managed care. Next slide. Another way to sort of think about the programs that are realigned is to think about how the funding structure existed prior to realignment for these programs. And basically that falls into into three categories as well. You can think about those programs in the health and human services account that were realigned that are entitlement programs, those that are non-entitlement programs that had been using federal funding, and those programs that were formerly funded entirely by the state general fund. And we see, when we say entitlement programs, what we mean is these are programs that we get federal money to pay for the part of the cost of those programs, and because we get that federal money, the feds say we have to provide these programs and we have to follow certain rules in how we run the programs. They're not optional. And they aren't optional in a realigned atmosphere either. The non-entitlement programs that utilize federal funding are just that. They're programs that we use federal funds in order to pay for part of the cost, and the feds allow us to use the money in that way, but they don't require it. So they don't say that we have to have the program or that we have to run it in a certain way, but they're allowing the funds to be used in that manner. And then the state general fund programs are just that. They're programs that were formally paid for 100% state general funds, and now that they're part of this realigned pot, they would be paid for out of the realignment funds. So next slide. Just to give some examples of what we are talking about when we say entitlement programs and non-entitlement programs that are partially federally funded, and then the state general funds, you can see some examples there. Foster care payments, adoption assistance payments, those are things that the feds say you have to have certain rules in place regarding how you do foster care maintenance payments and adoption assistance payments. You have to have those programs if you want the federal funding at all. The non-entitlement programs that have federal funding attached are state family preservation, for example, foster parent training and recruitment, or also another example, substance abuse and the HIV infant program, and then some examples of programs that were formally funded with entirely state general fund dollars or emancipated youth stipends, THP Plus, kinship support services programs. All of these programs have been realigned, but I think there are different policy implications of that realignment if you sort of look at the funding streams attached to these different kinds of programs. Just want to note that obviously these are not inclusive of all of the programs that were realigned. There are many programs that were realigned, and if you pull up the county fiscal letter that was released last October that's on the CDSS website, you can actually see at least a list of all of the different programs that fall under the health and human services account and these different sub-accounts. Obviously, they're not broken up by entitlement programs or state general fund programs, but at least you can see a full list of programs that were realigned and get a sense of what is included holistically in these realigned sub-accounts. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Susanna Niffen to sort of talk about the financing of realignment.
Okay, next slide. So as Angie mentioned, not only were certain programs realigned to the counties, but also the revenue source to pay for those. So in the 2011 realignment, there were three main revenue sources that were shifted to local governments to help them fund these new duties. The first was 1.065% of the sales tax, which came to a little over $5 billion. There was also a shift of 0.05% of the vehicle license fee, which came to $453 million. And in 2011-12, there was also a shift of some funds from Proposition 63, totaling $763 million. Although it should be noted that while the other two shifts were considered to be ongoing, Proposition 63 was just a one-time shift in funding. Revenue projections for the future show that they are expecting this to be an increasing amount of revenue in the coming years, although it should be noted that we're not exactly sure. This is a very fairly volatile pot of money, and we're not 100% sure how much will be coming in the current or future years, but we're hopeful that this will be an increasing revenue stream. Next slide. Just as it's difficult to predict what the revenue projections are in future years, it's also difficult to predict what the expenditure projections will be. There's really no good analysis of what we're going to need in the future for these children and youth. Some drivers of cost include caseload growth, either due to population growth or increased incidence rates. There could also be rate increases. For example, group homes were given a rate increase last year by the courts, and it is anticipated that in the future, foster family agencies are also looking for a rate increase through the courts. Another common driver of cost is the enrichment of programs. For example, newer programs have included KINGAP and AB12. There's also a growth in personnel costs. And these are all difficult to predict what amount we will need in the future for these programs. Next slide. While there hasn't been a lot put about this into the legislation at this point, it has been talked about a little bit. So if there are lower than expected revenues, each program will receive a proportionate share of the shortfall, except for mental health and local law enforcement services. If there is a higher than expected revenue level, this money will be placed into a reserve account, and it will go first to fund entitlement programs. So, for example, foster care, adoption assistance, and drug Medi-Cal. And it should be noted that this is only the proposal for the current year. Next slide. So I think this has been a big question at the county level. If realignment has happened, why haven't there been many notable changes for you in your counties? For one thing, the original one-year realignment proposal did not provide any significant policy changes related to the program for the 2011-12 fiscal year. It was a fiscal and financial realignment, but there was kind of a hold put on the policy changes, and counties were directed to continue business as usual for the current year. It did state as well that other issues around implementation and policy going forward would be addressed in legislation during the 2012 legislative session, hopefully going into effect for the 2012-13 budget year. So we just want to alert people that there may be very major policy changes that could begin as early as July of 2013. Actually, that should read July 2012. Next slide. There are a lot of potential policy implications of realignment for advocates and stakeholders to consider. There are some potential positive implications, which I think the governor is hoping he will see. We could see public safety developing a more integrated approach, so law enforcement working more closely with mental health providers, child welfare service providers, and other groups. There's also more local flexibility and fiscal authority to tailor programs to more closely fit their communities and their community needs. And in boom years, we could see an increase of funding directed to these programs. There are also some potential negative implications, however. One problem could be that services and supports will start varying drastically from county to county as each county begins to tailor programs to fit their community needs or their view of their community needs. Children and families in one county could receive very different services than children and families in another county. There also could be reduced oversight and accountability by the state as they no longer can direct counties on how to use their funding. There may be less oversight by the state on what is going on at a county level. Also, during times of fiscal crisis or any time that the sales tax revenue drops, we would see automatically reduced funding. I'm going to turn it over now to Martha Matthews from Public Counsel.
Actually, Susanna, it's we're now going to talk a little bit about 1991 realignment. So thank you very much. From here, I do want to turn our attention to 1991 realignment and then to the 2000 realignment structure, as well as Governor Brown's proposed structure in his that he included in his budget. In preparation for the web seminar, we had an interesting conversation about whether about this slide and whether it was too much information. So I hope my co-presenters don't mind that I indulge myself, and I feel like this information was very important, and I hope you do too. First, it's important to understand that this is not California's first experiment with realignment. And as probably most everyone on the line is aware, in 1991, the legislature adopted a realignment policy. And at that time, it shifted $2 billion in program responsibility to counties, which in today's dollars is about $4 billion. Now, for the field of child welfare, a significant change resulting from 1991 realignment was a reduction in the share or percentage of cost that the state paid for foster care, adoption assistance, and child welfare services. Now, as I'm sure many, if not most people are aware, these programs, the one you see on your slide in front of you, have traditionally been financed through a combination. It's really a shared responsibility of federal, state, and county dollars. And you can see from the slide, 1991 realignment reduced the non-federal share of costs for these programs significantly. As the slide shows, prior to 1991, 95% of non-federal foster care costs were funded by the state, along with a full 100% of adoption assistance costs. So as someone who was frankly still in college at that time, I was struck and have been struck at that. That's pretty amazing. These percentages reduced to 40% and 75% as a result of 1991 realignment. Now, with the 2011 realignment legislation, the responsibility to fund these programs has been shifted fully to the counties. The non-federal share of costs paid by the state for these programs, as you can see on the slide, have been reduced to zero. So what we really have from a finance perspective is a partnership. While there's still a very important role for the state, and Martha's going to talk more about that, fiscally, it's no longer a three-way partnership. And as Angie and Susanna explained earlier, in return for assuming the full fiscal responsibility for these programs in terms of the non-federal share of costs, through realignment, counties received a portion of the sales tax and vehicle license fees. So I hope you found that useful to understand. In many ways, 2011 realignment finished the realignment process, one that had started 20 years ago. Now let's turn to realignment today. In his fiscal year 2013 budget, Governor Brown included a proposal that has been referred to as the permanent funding structure. Now, it's called this because the 2000 realignment structure was always intended to be temporary, really a one-year structure, and there was an understanding that the legislature would adopt a permanent structure for fiscal year 2012-13 and beyond. The proposal that was included in the governor's draft budget was developed in consultation with the California State Association of Counties, which is known as CSAC. Now first, let's contrast the account structure, that first row, of the 2000 realignment and the administration CSAC proposal. Now, as you can see, the governor's proposal consolidates eight accounts into two major accounts. What I don't have on the slide, but what I can explain to you, is one account, proposed account, is called Support Services Account, and the second proposed account is called the Law Enforcement Services Account. Now, likewise, the number of sub-accounts has been reduced in the governor's proposal, particularly within the Support Services Account, which includes Child Welfare Services, foster care, and children's mental health, among other social services programs. Now, at this point, you may be asking yourself, Amy, who cares how many accounts and sub-accounts there are? The money goes locally. What difference does this make? The account structure, I would argue, is important because of its implications. The more accounts and sub-accounts there are, the more fiscally separate the programs are. The more consolidated programs are within accounts or sub-accounts, the more discretion it provides to use funding traditionally used for one program for another program. So therefore, while it may seem just like an administrative, you know, kind of aspect of the policy, it does have implications. Another difference between the 2011 realignment and the CSAC administration proposal is the amount of funding that may be transferred between accounts or subaccounts. On the slide, I've listed that as transferability. Some would argue that allowing the transfer of funds between accounts or subaccounts provides local government with more flexibility in how they spend their funds and create opportunities for local innovations. Others argue that allowing transfers between accounts or subaccounts may destabilize or even jeopardize the funding of individual programs. So how you see that is a little bit, you know, based on kind of where you stand. So as you can see from the slide, 2011 realignment did not allow any transfer funds between accounts or subaccounts. And as I said previously, that was most likely largely because this was intended as a one-year temporary structure. The governor proposes to allow up to 10% of the lesser subaccounts to be transferred within the support services account beginning in fiscal year 12-13, but restricts any transfer of funds between subaccounts of the law enforcement services account until fiscal year 15-16. Now, also implicit in that is there is no explicit transfer allowed between the two major accounts. Now let's turn our attention to the topic of allocation and base. Now, these terms simply refer to how the sales tax and vehicle license fee funds will be distributed between the two accounts and within the subaccounts. Both the 2000 realignment and the governor's proposal allocate funding generally based on historical spending. Now, the positive aspect of this approach is it results in a continuity of funding. Counties have gotten what they've gotten in the past, and they'll continue to roughly get that amount. The negative aspect, potentially, of this approach is that it institutionalizes inequitable distribution. And by that, if perhaps one county has not gotten what maybe they need based on their population or poverty level or some other factor, it would further institutionalize that inequitable distribution. Very fortunately, though, the governor's proposal makes growth funding for child welfare services a priority, which is very encouraging. Now, a big question that comes to mind, as Susanna raised, is when we think about realignment, is what happens if counties do not receive enough revenue to cover the cost of their newly assigned functions? Now, this really is a fair question, because the sales tax revenue is based on consumer spending, and consumer spending is influenced by factors far beyond the control of our state or our counties, such as the national economy. As Susanna explained, in 2011 realignment, in the case of a revenue shortage, each program would receive a proportional cut with the exception of two programs, and she explained that. The governor's current proposal refers to an unspecified statutory mechanism that would address this circumstance, which in essence is saying to be determined, kind of under investigation. There was no specific proposal put forth in the proposed budget. And so I think that is an opportunity certainly worth discussion and serious consideration. However, what we're all hoping for is that there will not be a shortage of revenue, but instead a growth in revenue from the sales tax and VLF. Under, and you'll see right there, excess revenues, this is referred to as growth. Under 2011 realignment, this growth would be deposited into a reserve account to fund entitlement programs, as Susanna explained. The governor proposed to change the structure and instead distribute the growth funding proportionally between the two main accounts and then the sub-accounts. So this appears to be movement in a way that is not favoring child welfare quite as directly. Finally is the issue of fiscal protections for counties. Now, the idea behind realignment is that counties assume responsibility for certain state functions, and in return, they receive a dedicated funding stream for those functions. Fiscal protections ensure that if counties are required to do more due to the requirements of a new state or federal law, they receive more funding. Now, without these fiscal protections, the cost to counties would increase significantly beyond the level of funding provided in realignment, and counties would be in the position of making difficult trade-offs between programs, something that none of us, I'm sure, want. Now, under the governor's proposal, counties would be protected from these new costs. As I'm sure many of you know, the governor has submitted a ballot proposal for the November 2012 election. If it passes, it stipulates the state would be fully responsible for the cost of implementing new state legislation and pay 50% of the cost of new federal legislation or any court cases or settlements. So that is a summary of 2011 realignment and the administration CSAC proposal, which was released on January 5th. Now with that, I'm going to turn it over to Martha Matthews, attorney with Public Counsel. Thank you, Martha.
Hi. Well, as Amy said, some of you may be wondering, well, what about the state? Because if the child welfare programs are now a partnership between the federal government, which still provides a substantial amount of funding, and the counties, which have both fiscal authority and fiscal responsibility, what is the role of the state Department of Social Services? And in fact, the governor's budget summary sort of anticipates this, basically expecting that the state government will shrink with realignment and charges CDSS along with other agencies to reduce its budget and operations by 25%. You know, so that, you know, that there should be an actual decrease in the amount of, you know, things that DSS does and the amount of people who work there. But the challenge here is that the federal Title 4B and 4E legislation under which California receives federal funding for child welfare programs requires that each state have what's called a single state agency to distribute the federal funds and oversee the administration of the child welfare system. The feds really don't want to deal with 52 different child welfare systems. The feds want to give their money to a single state agency and have that agency either administrate itself in state-based systems or oversee the administration of county-based child welfare systems. Even though the fiscal part of realignment sort of seems to bypass the state still has a key role to play in terms of ensuring California's compliance with federal law. Next slide, please. So what is what's CDSS still going to do? Next slide, please. Well, first of all, the CDSS is still going to be the fiscal agent. It's going to receive the federal money and distribute federal reimbursement to funds. The county is still going to use the same claiming system that it always has used to get Title 4E reimbursement for foster care payments. CDSS also has to ensure what is referred to as the statewideness of the child welfare state plan. earlier when Susanna was discussing the potential policy implications of realignment, one of the positive policy implications is flexibility, that counties should be able to respond to local priorities and local needs. However, the downside of that is the possibility that children and families could receive very different services in different parts of the state. The backstop that will limit the variances among child welfare programs in different parts of the state is that the elements of the child welfare state plan, which every state has to have to receive federal money, require certain things to be present in all parts of the state. And CDSS is still going to have to say to the counties, look, you know, you can't just stop providing reunification services. You know, there are certain things that you simply have to do. And so the county's flexibility is constrained by the necessity of continuing to comply with federal child welfare law. And the DSS has an important role in making sure the counties don't, so to speak, go too far. Also, as many of you on the call know, there is a very elaborate monitoring and compliance enforcement system. The CFSR is the Children and Family Services Review System. It's a federal compliance review system. California's version of that is called the CCFSR, the California Children and Families Service Review. And DSS will still have a role in running that monitoring and reporting back to the federal agency. Likewise, one of the results of monitoring is that you try to do system improvement. The state is still going to be administrating state's system improvement goals. The state also continues to have a role of coordinating among different programs. One of the federal state plan requirements is that child welfare, Medi-Cal, public benefits like CalWORKs, Title 20 benefits, all of these systems are supposed to connect to each other because they all receive federal financial participation. And so at the state level, the state should still be working to make sure those programs link properly to each other. Likewise, every state is required to have a statewide information system. The CMS CWS system is California's way of complying with that federal requirement. DSS is going to continue to run that system. DSS is going to continue to do licensing of placements. This is something that I suppose theoretically could have been delegated to the counties under realignment, but it hasn't been. And then finally, the state as a state needs to work with other states on issues such as the interstate compact on placement of children, on tribal Indian Child Welfare Act and tribal placement issues, because the state as an entity needs to negotiate with other states. DSS is still going to do that. So those are some of the examples of why that's sort of the 75% of DSS that is left after realignment. So you may be wondering, like, well, you know, what are they going to stop doing? Next slide, please.
One moment, just if you don't mind me interrupting, Martha. A number of people have emailed in saying they're having a little bit of trouble with audio, and that can happen if you're listening on your computer. So what I'd recommend is dialing into the number if you have that option. Just a couple people have notified us about that. So sorry about the interruption, and I'll change the slide.
Okay. Okay, well, one big thing that DSS is going to stop doing, and this is a practical on-the-ground change that we're going to start seeing quite soon, is that for those counties that haven't already started doing their own adoptions, more counties will start doing their own adoptions of children from the dependency system. Now, the counties can still choose to contract back with DSS if they really don't want to do their own adoptions. But DSS is projecting a substantial reduction in the amount of adoptions work it's going to do, and therefore in the amount of staff it's going to have and revenue it's going to need. So people will actually end up being laid off from DSS because the size of its adoptions work will shrink a lot. DSS will continue to do independent adoptions, the adoption approval for people who adopt children outside the child welfare system. So that's one fairly large practical change, and it's the biggest example that we know of a function that the state DSS will simply stop doing in many counties. Okay, next slide, please. So earlier I referred to the fact that the realignment does not change the legal mandates applicable to state child welfare systems. So we get quite a bit of federal money, mostly from Title IV-E, which is mostly foster care maintenance payments and adoption assistance payments. We also get quite a bit of Title IV-B money for family preservation and other child welfare programs. So because we take all this federal money, we are obligated to comply with the state plan requirements in the federal law. The consequence of not doing that is actual federal fiscal penalties. So DSS has a very strong motivation to ensure that the counties balance their increased flexibility under realignment with continuing to comply with federal law. Likewise, state substantive law governing child welfare programs is not going away. All of the provisions in the Welfare and Institutions Code that says the social worker shall, the county agency shall, and lays out very detailed and specific things that county agencies must do in individual child welfare cases, none of those mandates will go away. And the consequence of not complying with those mandates will be that the courts in individual cases, obviously, will order the counties to comply, and also collectively, the counties may start, may experience the courts getting frustrated and not making the reasonable efforts findings that are required to claim federal reimbursement under Title IV-E. So the substantive law about what the counties are supposed to do for children and families in their child welfare system has not changed. Just the way the programs are structured and the fiscal authority and responsibility has shifted to the counties. So the big question is, how will the counties play out their new role and yet still comply with substantive law? Next slide, please. So I've been talking about these federal state plan requirements, and the state plan requirements are lengthy. You can read them yourself if you like that sort of thing, but I just wanted to highlight a few of the major ones. Everyone on the call has probably heard the phrase reasonable efforts. That's kind of like the cornerstone of federal child welfare policy. Essentially, what the feds are saying to California and other states is, we'll pay a substantial share of your foster care maintenance costs, but you better try as best you can to minimize the number of people who need to use foster homes. And the way to do that is, first of all, prevention of out-of-home placement, reunification efforts, and permanency, moving children out of the foster care system and into adoption and guardianship if they can't reunify. So essentially, the condition of receiving federal subsidies for foster homes is efforts to minimize the use of foster homes. Likewise, the feds say, you know, sure, go ahead and use our money, but every child needs to have an appropriate case plan, and there has to be a case review system in place so that cases don't just sort of drift forever with no clear goal and no benefit to the child. The feds, and then there's a couple of other bullets, and remember, these are examples from a very long list of state plan requirements. The feds require every state to recruit and train foster parents so that you're not just spending federal money placing the kids with just anybody, that you've really made an effort to find people who are qualified to meet children's special needs, who are in the geographic areas close to the children's homes, neighborhoods, and schools, who have the capacity to keep siblings together. There's all these requirements about proper recruitment. And then likewise, the feds say, you know, if we're going to subsidize the state keeping children in out-of-home care, the state had better be a competent substitute for a parent, in that the state had better ensure adequate education and health care for foster children. So those are examples of state plan requirements. And like I said, the consequence for noncompliance with the state plan is there are fiscal penalties, which the state really wants to avoid, and obviously the counties share that motivation. So how would anyone know whether California or its counties are complying with the state plan? Because those requirements, as you may have noticed, are rather broad and abstract. And the answer is the CFSR, which I referred to before. The Federal Performance Review System includes 7 key measures of child safety and well-being, and these are the 7 measures on this slide: protection from abuse and neglect, safety at home, stability and permanency, preserving family connections, increasing families' capacity to care for children, education, and then physical and mental health care. And then, as I said, there is a California version of the CFSR, which further breaks down those 7 measures into very specific data points that that are extracted in various ways, both from statistical data through the CMS-CWS system and through qualitative case review. Many of you are familiar with it. There's this very elaborate case review system. So those are the compliance measures for child safety and well-being, and then there's a separate set of measures. Next slide, please. These are system measures. Basically, the feds are saying for a state or county child welfare agency to have the capacity to keep children safe and ensure family well-being, these are characteristics of the systems that they would need to have. They need to have a good information system. They need to have an adequate service array. They would need to have a functioning case review system, adequate training, quality assurance, and, you know, sort of system feedback. They'd need to have some way to get input from stakeholders about how, you know, the child welfare services are impacting the community, and they would need to make consistent efforts on recruitment, licensing, and retention. So this CFSR also includes the system measures that are supposed to measure capacity to achieve the performance measures in terms of child safety and well-being. So that's what the federal compliance review requires. As I said, the state has its own version of it. Next slide, please. And the CFSR has 4 main components. First of all, as many of you know, there's quarterly data reporting that gets inputted into CMS-CWS. And then on the qualitative side, the counties do self-assessment, self-assessment process. There's also a peer review process involving reviewers from other counties, from, you know, outside reviewers. And then as that process identifies issues in which the counties are not performing up to standard, the county creates system improvement plans. And just noting that, you know, all of this sounds very, you know, very good and very well organized and very detailed. The problem is that actual compliance is a pretty elusive goal. The most recent round of CFSR reviews was completed in 2008. There was substantial noncompliance in many of the counties, and therefore the state had to enter into a state performance improvement plan, which was finalized in January of 2010 with the federal agency. So currently the state of California is in a process to try to come into compliance with federal law, and, you know, the ultimate consequence of not doing that is fiscal penalties, although the feds have not imposed those penalties yet, but they could. So next slide, please. So what happens if all of this performance measurement and compliance review doesn't work? Ultimately, these are DSS's current powers to compel the counties to come into compliance. There is a statute that allows DSS to actually bring an action in court for an injunction from a judge to hold a state hearing. DSS does have the authority to withhold funds from the county, even under realignment. Again, these statutes have not been repealed. And then the ultimate penalty is that DSS could step in and run a troubled county child welfare system. Now, none of these things have ever actually happened. What has happened in the past is that CDSSS has provided technical assistance, has worked with the counties to develop the county's system improvement plans, and has sort of been content to kind of work on incremental improvement rather than these more drastic enforcement measures. However, the question remains, under realignment, is this current system of performance review and accountability, is that system going to be sufficient and effective? And that is an open question. Next slide, please. So the big picture about accountability and compliance is that you have the counties have direct control of funds. So those funding sources don't go into the state general fund and get parceled out to the counties. As Susanna explained, they go straight to the counties. But the counties still have to claim their federal costs using the same system that they always did, FFP, and that side is federal financial participation. And the counties are still subject to the same substantive law requirements under state and federal law that they always were, but they may have some flexibility. I mean, if you know you have to provide reasonable efforts, but you can maybe decide how to provide reasonable efforts. You could use a new model of family group conferencing or early prevention services, or, you know, there may be more flexibility under realignment about exactly how to do what you must do under the state and federal laws. And then the ultimate sort of, you know, where the buck stops is that if the counties go too far, so to speak, and eliminate programs that are required under the state plan rules, and so that CDSS can no longer prove to the feds that there is a state plan that is in effect in all subdivisions of the state, the ultimate sanction could be an actual loss of federal money. And as you can see from the proposal that it's likely that the counties, that there would be some sort of legislation saying that the counties would share this risk with the state, that if there were any penalties imposed, the state and the counties would share the penalties. But that hasn't been spelled out yet either. So with that is about as much as we know about the ongoing role of the state DSS and the provisions for measuring performance and, you know, measuring actual outcomes in terms of, you know, how are the county child welfare systems performing in terms of their impact on children and families, and who is accountable if they're not performing well. What I've told you is all we know so far, but any or all of this could change in when the policy legislation starts to be introduced. With that, I will turn this over to Amy for the last segment of the presentation.
Thank you, Martha. So with that, we've talked about the structure of 2011 realignment, the revenue revisited 1991 realignment, I discussed accountability and the role of the state. And so on the presentation in front of you are some, but not all, certainly, of the questions that the legislature is going to consider when they revisit realignment. And I think what is important to understand, I know you all know this, but sometimes when we need to kind of fully embrace that, you know, it's a process. The governor proposes something. The legislature, you know, obviously through budget hearings, reviews that, and there's a lot of opportunity to influence that process. And so together, the legislature and the governor are going to be thinking and working on these questions. And as you can see, these are the core questions about revenue allocation, account structure, and accountability. How will revenue be allocated? We talked about how it was done for 2011 realignment. We talked about how the governor's kind of proposed it. But what will it be? Will shifting of funds between accounts or subaccounts be allowed? Again, we know what the proposal is, but as Martha said, a lot of this is an open question. In the case of lower than expected revenues, how will the cuts be distributed? There's a reference to a statutory mechanism. What that will ultimately be is undetermined. We can probably develop some thoughts of our own and perhaps recommend those with an eye towards the needs of abused and neglected children and youth. Another question is in the case of higher than expected revenue or what's known as growth, how will those funds be treated? Again, is there a case to be made that those funds should first go to entitlement programs, which counties are legally mandated to provide regardless of whether the realigned funding is adequate or not? Another question is reporting requirements, and that really speaks to what Martha is talking about, is we have a very extensive accountability system now. Does that work in a realigned context? Does it need additional supports? Just thinking through that process so that we can know that we do have a robust statewide system and one that can be there for all children and youth in California. And really how we answer these questions will determine the funding landscape for children and youth for many years to come. Again, we can't realign any farther. In 1991, realignment, 20 years passed under that realignment structure until we arrived at 2011 realignment. However, there's nowhere to go from here. The only option would be potentially to try and unrealign a portion of it, but frankly, that's not likely to happen. So the conversations and the questions, the dialogue that's going to happen in the next several months, it's our moment to really weigh in, to participate, and to think about these issues so that we can, frankly, get the best deal possible for children. We have a wonderful child welfare state program, and we have a lot to lose if it does not stay as strong as it currently is. And if anyone maybe wonders about that, I really encourage you to look at the 2010 maltreatment report that was just released by the federal government. And, you know, measure for measure, California is doing better than most states. We have a lot to be proud of there. So we're going to conclude today's presentation with really an appeal for you to get involved. As Angie said at the beginning of the presentation, I don't know how many times I've bound my BART right over to San Francisco, read about criminal justice realignment. What about child welfare realignment? Where's the robust public discourse in that arena? So we're really going to invite you to get involved. When we conclude today's presentation, you are going to get a follow-up email. It's going to include the slides. Many of you have requested those, so you're going to get those today. And I'm also going to tell you exactly where it will be. The recorded presentation will be on the website. That likely won't be posted. I'm going to give us until Monday, just because there's a lot going on. But when you get that follow-up email, there's also going to be a link in it where we're going to ask you to follow that link into your name, your organization, and your email. And if you do that, you're going to have an opportunity to learn about ways to get involved over the next couple months. And you can see the options, you know, that are currently under consideration on your slide. One is we all want to continue learning about this issue by participating in informational briefings. We also want to learn how realignment may affect specific programs. So Angie kind of alluded to three categories of programs. And many of you on this call, if you're in a large multi-service agency, this policy touches many of your programs. And so we want to find ways to give you specific information about the potential implications of your specific programs. To endorse a set of child-focused policy recommendations on realignment, educating legislators through meetings and letters. And then how can we work together to inform the general public that that the child welfare community is a well-organized group of people and that we really are going to work as hard as possible to ensure that the final policy that's adopted best meets the needs of children and youth. So again, you'll get that follow-up email today. Really encourage you to add your name to the group of people who's interested in getting involved. There's no pressure. You're not going to be like hounded. It's really just going to be a way of staying abreast of developments, and you can participate as you are available. So with that, we are going to turn to the Q&A section of today's web seminar. We've gotten a lot of interesting questions along the way, and you know, I'm just going to start the Q&A session by telling you we're not going to be able to answer them all. I mean, the real experts, frankly, on realignment are the counties. They lived through 1991 realignment, and they are the most absolutely familiar with the current realignment issues. So the ones that are kind of beyond the scope, our scope, we're going to follow up and track down those answers. But there are other ones that I think we can address, and let's do that by starting with Susanna. Here's one for you. Susanna, the person has typed in, what happens if the realignment funding structure is approved by the legislature in July in the budget process, but then in November, the governor's ballot measure doesn't pass? What happens? Or what is your read of what could happen? I know there's no crystal balls here.
Yeah, and so just with that caveat, I think what we've talked about is that this would leave counties with full responsibility for any changes in the future. So if caseload does go up or if other things happen, the counties are kind of on the hook for making sure all of those things are paid for in some way. It really leaves them with very little protection. The other problem if the ballot measure fails is that the funding structure, which is intended to be permanent for the counties, would not be. So theoretically, in the future, different legislatures could take away that funding and leave counties with the responsibilities but without the funding. So it really places counties in some jeopardy and with a lot of risk on their plate if they do not get the constitutional protections in November.
Thank you, Susanna. The next question, Angie, is for you. It says, what about extending foster care to age 21? Under realignment, who would pay for that additional year of service for older youth in care?
So Fostering Connections, or AB 12, expanded an entitlement program. So if you go back to thinking about what we talked about at the beginning of the presentation, foster care maintenance payments, which is what AB 12 provides for, are part of the entitlement. We've now taken up that federal opportunity to continue to assist youth after age 18 and in full implementation up to age 20. And what that means is we have to do that. It's an obligation that the counties and the state have. Our state plan is being amended to account for those young people. And so it will be part of what the counties are obligated to pay for. And the feds obviously pay their share of the cost for those youth that are federally eligible. I think it's important to note that part of AB 12 was converting our old KINGAP program to the new KINGAP program. The counties are realizing those savings from KINGAP. So, you know, outside of even the realignment funds that were through the vehicle licensing fee and the sales tax, there's also those savings from KINGAP. But the short answer to the question is it's the counties that are obligated to continue to provide for those youth as an entitlement.
I think the question, Angie, was from age, you know, currently goes to age 20. If, you know, if realignment is here, and let's say the budget proposal passes, and then a bill is passed to go from 20 to 21, who pays then?
Oh, from 20 to 21. I think if the constitutional amendment passes and it's new state legislation, I don't know, Amy, do you have a take on that? I mean, if the constitutional amendment passes, I suppose it would be under state because it would be a new bill that would be passed after this year.
That is correct. That is what the ballot proposition says. New state legislation would be 100%.
Right.
So one question we've gotten is about EPSDT. And, you know, EPSDT, as we all know, is a critical part of our child welfare system, even though it's technically a mental health program, but it is used in concert with all of our foster care services to serve youth who needs that. And this question is also for you, Angie. What about EPSDT? Has it been realigned? And if so, what does that mean for the program?
So EPSDT, it's the same answer, actually, that I just gave. EPSDT hasn't been realigned yet. It's set to be realigned. It will join the list of realigned programs this year. So in the 2012-13 budget year, and EPSDT is also entitlement money, meaning we
say to the feds, we operate this program, we're obligated to operate it to provide EPSDT benefits and services. I think what it actually means has some interesting questions attached to it, but in terms of obligation to continue to provide the services and pay for the costs associated with those services, that's entitlement funding.
Okay. Let's see. I'm trying to pick ones of these questions that have broad appeal. A question is, are there any protections for counties if there is a state court case or settlement in the constitutional amendment or elsewhere? Yes, and you know, I encourage those of you, it's not very long, this ballot proposal, I think like 8 pages, but in it you can see that there are protections for the county where any, and you can see it on slide, when we send out the slide, that the state would pay 50% of the cost for court case settlements. So that is included in the ballot proposition. Susanna, this question is for you. Foster care caseloads are at record lows in California. Does this establish a low base for realigned funds?
It does, to a certain extent. I think if people are familiar with the original waiver counties, Los Angeles and Alameda, they were kind of block granted at a time when caseloads were very high. However, this realignment is being done when caseloads are at historic lows, and so it is being realigned at technically a low base. That is why there is some concern that if caseloads do start to climb again, you know, the funding may not be sufficient to continue all of the services that we want to provide for these youth and to take care of the entitlement services that we have to do.
Martha, this question is for you. Could you just kind of repeat or about CDFS's role in licensing?
My understanding, and I don't know if this is the final answer, is that CDFS will continue to do its current licensing functions more or less unchanged under realignment. It wouldn't necessarily have to do that. There are some things that under the federal state plan requirements pretty much have to be done by the state as a state, for example, negotiating with other states over ICPC. I could imagine a situation in which each county does its own licensing function, but so far I think just because that would be pretty inefficient and chaotic, CDSS is going to retain the licensing function more or less unchanged. If anyone else has any different information, please chime in, but that's what I've heard so far.
Thank you, Martha. This is another question for you, which is about adoption. I'm going to just summarize it a little bit rather than read it word for word, but essentially the person has written in that they understand that counties will be doing adoptions, and will counties get additional resources and support to what he refers to as bring up their adoptions operations?
They will certainly get support. One of the things that CDSS very strongly wants to continue doing is its function of sort of training, information sharing, sharing best practices among counties, and you know, sort of technical assistance. So I know that DSS is very actively engaged now in providing technical assistance to counties that are essentially building their own adoptions units. And however, additional resources, I mean, again, remember that the counties get the realigned funds. They can either use that money to establish an adoptions unit if they don't already have one and do adoptions in-house, or I believe that because DSS has capacity to do this, they can contract back with DSS and say, no, really, you keep doing that. And in that case, the counties would basically be giving back some of their realigned funds to DSS. So they won't get any additional resources, but they may choose to use their resources either to do adoptions in-house with technical assistance from DSS, or for some of the smaller counties who may find that inefficient, they can still contract back with DSS to continue doing it. And I know that DSS has been in active discussions with a bunch of different counties about, you know, well, you know, you got to tell us which you're going to do because they have to do their own planning.
This question, next question, Angie, I'm going to ask to you. You talked about, you know, the categories of programs and different programs. I don't think there's like a firm answer on this, but from your point of view, do you anticipate that realignment will have a significant impact on prevention / early intervention funding?
Prevention and early intervention funding, I think that would fall into the category of funding that we utilize 4E dollars for. I think Martha has talked about some of the state plan requirements that require reasonable efforts to avoid removal. In terms of the actual dollars, we have, you know, the payments for foster care maintenance payments and adoption assistance payments that absolutely have to be made, and you've got a bunch of other programs that are in the same, that are competing for the rest of the resources once you pay for the things that you absolutely have to pay for. I think that's the easiest way to put it. I think counties are going to continue, hopefully, to prioritize early intervention and prevention services. I think it leads to performance, you know, having outcomes and avoiding penalties from the feds in terms of what their performance is and looking good on the federal measures that Martha talked about. So, I mean, I think that there's a strong incentive to continue to adequately fund those kinds of programs.
Okay. I'll take the next question, and it is a question about has there been any evaluation of 1991 realignment generally or as it specifically affected child welfare service outcomes? The only kind of evaluation, which I think that word is used, it's a more of a descriptive evaluation, but it's a very, very interesting read, is one that was done by the LAO, and the date on it, if you go to their website, is February 6, 2001. And it gives a very interesting telling of how 1991 realignment played out and what areas it seemed to work and areas where not so much. But again, it's descriptive. We don't really, and it doesn't really speak, it speaks to 1991 realignment from what it says intended to control the costs of child welfare services more than it did. And it was not successful on that front, although I think many of us on this call wouldn't necessarily think of that as a success. So again, it's kind of the vantage point you come at. But if you're interested in that, it's up on the LAO website. The date's February 6, 2001, and it's called Realignment Revisited, an Evaluation of the 1991 Experiment in State-County Relations. We'll take a question or two more, and then, probably break. So here's a question. Again, I think I'm going to ask this to you, Angie, and it's really asking about the capped allocation project, you know, the 4E waiver counties. And it asks, does the current realignment affect 4E waiver and non-4E waiver counties the same way? Do you have anything to kind of say about that?
I think the simple answer is really not quite, because the waiver counties are fully realigned, if you want to think about it that way. They've already accepted or block granted what they get from the feds, and so they have different flexibility, different abilities to spend those federal dollars that we were talking about on things that aren't just necessarily foster care maintenance payments, but use that federal money to fund a whole range of services. And now they're essentially getting a block grant, it's an easier way to think about it, from the state as well. And so it's sort of full realignment as opposed to the other counties that we're talking about that are still operating under the federal scheme where every youth in care has federal dollars attached to that youth. And so it's a different different federal dollars are coming into the non-waiver counties than are coming into the waiver counties, which have a capped allocation from the feds.
Thanks, Angie. One person during your portion of the presentation, Susanna, was unclear why you were hoping tax revenue would increase. Kind of clarify why that would be a positive outcome.
If sales tax revenue increases, remember that we now, there has been 1.065% of whatever sales tax revenue is that will go to the locals for these programs. So as sales tax increases, so sales tax revenue increases, so does the amount that we receive. That 1% is greater of a greater amount of sales tax revenue.
Okay. Well, you know, there are some questions we're getting that are about specific programs, you know, and I think that that's partially around, you know, what are these individual programs? And as Angie said, the ACL, or I think it's like an all-county fiscal letter, I'm not sure exactly what it is, the title is, but it's a quite a document, and it does list all of the programs. And we're going to try and make an effort to make it a little bit more user-friendly, because while technically you can go and read it, it's a little daunting. So we're going to try and break that down so that people understand, like, is this an entitlement program? Is it a non-entitlement program that has a federal participation rate and maybe it's still a requirement, or maybe it's not a required. And then, again, those programs that are, I think, and that's, you know, as an organization that's been long invested in THP Plus, certainly an area of concern. You know, former 100% state general funded programs, how we think about those and what this policy means for those, and how we can start to begin having conversations with our local board of supervisors to really encourage the continuation of these programs, because there's a lot of people that rely on them. So I'm sorry that we weren't able to get to everyone's questions. I didn't want ones that I felt like, based on our preparation for the web seminar, we're a little bit maybe beyond our scope. Didn't want to just totally venture guesses, but I am going to, everyone who submitted a question is going to get some of kind of response, either with the answer or saying that we'll get back to you. So I do appreciate everyone who submitted questions and everyone who's been on the web seminar today. So on behalf of Children Now, Public Counsel, Alliance for Children's Rights, and the John Burton Foundation, thank you very much for being on the web seminar. Again, I'm going to email out the presentation, and the web seminar with the full audio will be posted at the California Fostering Connections website and by next Monday. Okay, thank you very much. Goodbye.